Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Squawker Talker. My name is Nick English, and joining me today, the first day of the greatest week in the football calendar, International Week, of course, is Ollie Young-Miles. Hello, Ollie.
Hello, Nick. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, mate?
Yeah, all good.
Excellent news. Excellent news. Also joining us is Mohamed Butts.
Once again,
Mo. Yeah.
Looking forward to International Week. It's going to be some really good, really meaningful... I'm lying.
It's okay. There's a couple of talking points, but first of all, we need to review what was a really cracking weekend of Premier League action. And where else to start but Chelsea 0, Man City 1. Probably tactically the most interesting game there's been in the Premier League for years, Ollie. How did Guardiola mastermind it? Because not only did Man City win, but they really just choked the life out of a Chelsea team who just looked completely dominated across the pitch.
Yeah, it was interesting. Chelsea got absolutely destroyed all over the park by City, who outpressed them, outpassed them, and outthought them really for the whole game. Guardiola, yeah, it was a Guardiola masterclass. But I think Mo probably has a lot to say on the Guardiola aspects. But I think Conte got it wrong as well. You know, we were just talking before then about when Morata came off, which is obviously a huge blow for Chelsea. They lost that sort of focal point up top. And rather than bringing on Batshuayi, who was flying off scoring that goal against Atletico, he brought on Willian. And it didn't really work out. You know, they had Willian and Hazard sort of running into the same spaces for a lot of the time. But City were very impressive. You know, I've been saying the past few weeks, while they've been banging goals in against everyone, they've been doing a lot of that the last 3 or 4 years. Mm. I think keeping it tight at the back is what is really sort of making them the standout team this year. And the fact that Chelsea had 2 shots on target, I think, all game shows that they just completely snuffed out any threat that Chelsea had.
Well, another interesting stat is that Chelsea only created 4 chances during the game, Kevin De Bruyne by himself creating 6. But there was so much going on in that team, Mo. We had Delph and Walker playing like sort of half central. We had De Bruyne and Silva drifting to the right wing quite a lot. We had, Sané and Sterling really high, really wide, pinning back. There was a lot going on
there.
As
Ollie says, it was a masterclass. It was absolutely brilliant from Pep. Everything he did was designed to absolutely shut down Chelsea's 3-5-2. Because the 3-5-2 system, okay, the problem with 3-5-2 is it's too easy to kill the wits in the team. Obviously, you can double up with your fullbacks and your wingbacks and your wingers to push the wingbacks forward. But then obviously that leaves you open to counters when your fullbacks are half the field.
Exactly.
So what Pep did was he just said, okay, right, Sané and Sterling, stay high, stay wide, push their wingbacks as far back as you can. And, you know, and then Gabriel Jesus, okay, I want you to you know, sort of mix it around and try and just be a good centre forward. And Gabriel Jesus can do, this is in a way why the Aguero, it's not a blessing to lose Aguero for that long, but he wouldn't have worked in the system, because as much as he has improved, he can't do what Jesus did, which is a lot of selfless work, a lot of very intelligent runs to move the centre backs around to basically be a decoy. I mean, and that flick back to De Bruyne for the goal was beautiful. Yeah. But the key thing was the fullbacks. That was the key, because basically the idea was, okay, look, we're gonna pulse the fullbacks high and wide, and we're gonna basically create run at their midfield and run at their defence with our two best players, Kevin De Bruyne and David Silva. But then you do that, you leave Fernandinho by himself in midfield, right? So then, but what Pep then did was ingenious, really. He tried to do it last season, at the start of the season, we all saw it, but he didn't have the players for it. Yeah. Brings the fullbacks now into midfielders.
Yeah, and it's perfect having someone like Fabian Delph, is a central midfielder.
Fabian Delph is a midfielder playing out position at left back. Did a decent job at left back, and now actually did a decent job in this sort of inverted fullback role.
He was brilliant.
He was really good. Fullbacks under Guardiola start in the half space, and usually, most fullbacks actually start in the half space, and usually what they do is they go wide from there. Mm-hmm. Pep brought them narrow instead, and they came in the team in either side of Fernandinho, so he was never alone in midfield. There was always two men either side of him, and then the two centre backs were where they were, and it was this sort of weird like 5-man back line kind of thing.
And it's a hybrid of 3 different formations.
Yeah, and it essentially allowed De Bruyne and Silva to sort of move forward, move into areas where they can attack the ball. De Bruyne creates more chances than anyone else, as you said, sent in about 10 crosses, I think. You know, really attack, and they could double up on one flank as well, because they did it a lot as well. They doubled up on the right flank, their right flank, Chelsea's left, and they left N'Golo Kante essentially free, because they know that N'Golo Kante, as opposed to Cesc Fabregas and Timo Bakayoko, N'Golo Kante is not really going to hurt you with the ball.
Yeah.
He does his best work off the ball. So they sort of gambled a bit and left him sort of one, left Delph to sort of, and Motomedi sort of control that area. Mm. And Chelsea's best forays happen in that area for that very reason. But it was just the way Pep used his fullbacks to basically club midfield while also holding width was just incredible. And it gave De Bruyne and Silva the room to move. And it's no surprise then that De Bruyne scored the goal.
Very well put, very concise analysis of that. There was so much going on that 11, you know, you need a lot to break it down. Ollie, Chelsea have failed to score in back-to-back Premier League home games for the first time since November 2012. Obviously, their two opponents were Arsenal and City, but they got stopped from scoring in two very different ways. A lot of Chelsea fans are saying that Morata going off injured was the turning point in the game, but they didn't look to have a sniff.
No, well, he had that sort of half chance at the beginning with a header, which you'd usually expect him to hit the target from. It kind of drifted wide. But yeah, when he came off, they lost that focal point, as I said, and they, you know, they really, really lacked that, which is why not bringing on Batshuayi was a really strange one. Chelsea needs to find other ways of winning. You know, I think last year they got into such a sort of run of momentum that they were just steamrolling teams, and teams were finding it very difficult to counter their wingbacks, especially until sort of February and March when they started to lose a couple of games. But Hazard as well. I mean, we saw last season against United, he got completely tactically outmarked of that game towards the end of last season. It happened again last night. I think this week we've seen the sort of the best and worst from Hazard in that free-roaming 10 role against Atletico. It was brilliant.
Didn't even create a chance against Man City.
Yeah, I mean, that's the worst part of Hazard. You know, usually he's brilliant, but when he's not playing, it's like playing with 10 men because he just didn't do anything at all.
He drifts in and out of games, and that's always been his sort of strength because it allows him to find spaces, you know, in amongst defensive markers. But the problem, people forget about him because he just sort of wanders around, not really touching the ball. But then the problem is, of course, if you can't get him the ball in the right places or can't have the right guys running off him, he then becomes, it's too easy to isolate him, as Ollie said. And that's exactly what City did. And I mean,
sounds very similar to another playmaker in North London.
Well, I mean,
playing
at
the Emirates.
But you know, unlike that one, people want to cut Hazard some slack for, I don't know why. Maybe he just doesn't look as depressed. But but Hazard is Hazard's a brilliant player. But the thing is, what I thought Conte, Ollie alluded to it, I thought Conte made a huge mistake when Morata had to go off injured. Okay, that's a big blow. You lose your main striker. Okay, but it's not just that he didn't bring on Batshuayi. I thought with Morata going, so does the whole 3-5-2. Because Batshuayi is not really the kind of big target man striker.
You go back to the 3-4-3.
That's exactly what you should go to. Yeah, and I thought right there and then he should have taken off Cesc and Morata and brought on Pedro and Batshuayi, and then
Pedro was very good when he came on eventually.
Well, exactly, because then you're playing your standard formation 3-4-2-1. Then you've got two wide players, and it makes it harder for City's formational gamble to work. Basically,
One question we've actually had is RD Cam asks: Conte didn't seem to know how to counter Pep's tactics on Saturday. Is it an insight into Chelsea's potential trouble with two games a week? It's interesting because Conte's very much had the tactical edge over most of the Premier League with his initial setup. Here he obviously didn't. Pep had him completely outfoxed. And when he tried to change it, it really didn't work. I mean, do you agree with RD Cam that this might be symptomatic of the two games a week and he has to be fresher with his ideas?
Without doubt. I think the two games per week is a really important point here because, you know, we look at the last two Premier League champions, Leicester and Chelsea, neither had Champions League football to contend with, and it obviously helped them both massively. And Chelsea had a much, much trickier time of it this week than City did. You know, they had Atletico away on the Wednesday night, got back at 4 a.m. I think on Thursday.
Yeah.
City had a relatively comfortable game against Shakhtar for the most part. I mean, you know, Shakhtar kept them quiet for a long time, but eventually they sort of broke through. And it's up to Chelsea to show that they can do this, because the last time they were in the Champions League and had the Premier League, they finished 10th. So, you know, it comes down to their squad. I mean, Chelsea fans have been moaning a lot the past few transfer windows that they're weakening the squad without really getting, you know, the sort of X-factor players in. They've sold a lot of good squad players, and it sort of comes down to, you know, is this bare 11 good enough to compete on two fronts? It probably isn't, because on the basis of the weekend, they look mentally and physically fatigued.
I mean,
sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, I was saying all last season, everyone was ready to anoint Chelsea as the new elite side in England. I was like, let's see how they fare with two competitions a week, because Conte was so far ahead of everyone else last season because he had a week to prepare. And yeah, it's like when you have a week to prepare and you don't have a catastrophic defence and a bad goalkeeper like Jurgen Klopp was at Liverpool, you know, you can do things like Chelsea did. So, I mean, you know,
they had the same 13, 14 players last season. Yeah.
Exactly. They have. They, you know, they sold their depth. They didn't really replace it. Morata's fantastic. Okay, fine. And this is why I've been saying Zappacosta's their best player, because he's something different. Everyone else, all the other good signings, are just replacing other players. Mm. They need to do his work in January, basically.
Speaking of squad depth, we've got a question from Carl Anker, who's a Squawker Talker regular. He asks, is Fabian Delph the store brand Lahm or the store brand Ashley Young? Ollie, I'll let you field this one.
Well, I quite like how, you know, Delph, Milner and Young were all playing in midfield for Villa a few years ago. Yeah. Now they're all reinvented as left-backs, which is a little bit bizarre.
Gareth Barry remains a central midfielder, though.
He's immovable. You can't get rid of Gareth Barry.
He was very, very good, Delph, and it's kind of weird that, I mean...
It was surprising how good he was.
Yeah, he's the kind of player that you'd think Pep wouldn't have a need for, but his versatility, I mean, he's very, very, you know, he's got great stamina, he's got a good left foot, and with Mendy out, they don't really have a natural left back, so he kind of just slots right in. I think it's probably a little bit early to be anointing him as the next Philip Lahm, but...
Thorbrand Lahm.
Thorbrand Lahm.
Maybe the Ashley Young.
Maybe the Ashley Young.
I think the thing is that he works hard and he takes instruction well, and I think that's a really underrated quality in a lot of football.
He's really solid as well.
I forgot how agile he was. I know that sounds like a really niche compliment, but he is so agile. He's so light on his feet.
And that's actually a key thing when you're playing football in tight spaces. One of the best things you've got to do is readjust your balance and to keep to play the ball, and that really helps. And, you know, I mean, Delph was saying 2 months into Guardiola's reign, I've never actually been coached. This is amazing. Mm. And everyone was surprised when he didn't leave. He's like, why would I leave? I'm in the best place I want to be. I'm getting coached properly, and Ronnie needs to stay fit. And Guardiola has shown repeatedly that if you're taking instruction well and you're fit, he'll use you. You know, as long as you are good enough in the system. And
as long as you do exactly as he says.
Exactly. That's literally it. Look at Pedro. And Pedro became a world-class footballer just by doing exactly what Guardiola said.
What a control freak. Well, yeah. Newcastle 1, Liverpool 1. Benitez has still never lost to Liverpool as a manager. Interesting point from this, Ollie, is that Philippe Coutinho has scored more Premier League goals from outside the box since 2012-13 than any other player. But what is the point of him continually scoring long-range bangers when Liverpool are going to throw it away?
Yeah, again, defensively, we talk about every single week.
It's really boring, actually, putting together these agendas and it comes to the Liverpool bit. Well, it's another defensive issue. Yeah.
Well, the thing with Liverpool, as we've been saying the last two or three weeks, defensively, you can never trust on them. A bit like City last year, actually. City outscored a lot of teams, but they were always conceding. So when they weren't flying forward and you know, putting three or four past the team, they'd be in trouble. And that's what Liverpool are sort of in at the moment. I think their sort of lack of a real top-class centre-forward is sort of coming back to haunt them a little bit this season, because this is the season of the strikers right now. Every other top six club has got a striker banging in goals.
Yeah.
Liverpool don't have that. They brought Sturridge in at the weekend. He just looked so off the pace. Firmino has been really off form as well. So that's their issue at the moment. You know, they're always going to concede a goal. They never look like keeping a clean sheet. And if they're not taking their chances, then, you know, they're going to draw games against teams like Newcastle.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing with Liverpool. You know, you bring up there the striker. You know, it's okay to play with a false nine system, but you need to have that plan B as a reliable goal-scoring striker who can come off the bench and make it difference. Because sometimes a false nine is not going to work.
Yes, and my fantasy team knows very well. Firmino in there for 4 weeks is killing me.
Well, there you go. I mean, and that's exactly it. Sometimes it'll fly and you'll decimate teams. Sometimes it just will look absolutely stagnant.
Well, that's a really good point, because Liverpool in the Premier League, since beating Arsenal, they've had 82 shots, 20 of those shots have been on target, and they only scored 5 goals.
I mean, there you go, right there. 20 shots out of 82 have been on target. I mean, that just shows the scattershot nature of the way they're playing. You know, and with Firmino and Salah, it's always, I mean, and to be fair, I'm pretty sure like at least 20 of those shots are Salah off target, but you know, the way that movement and decimating teams on the break is all well and good, but part of what made Jurgen Klopp so special at Borussia Dortmund was the fact that they played with such intensity and physicality and they played on the break so much. But the thing is, all that stuff is basically bog standard in the Premier League. Mm-hmm. And I think part of what's taken a lot of the shine off Jurgen Klopp, I mean, yes, obviously, the fact that he just repeatedly will not sign a centre-half. I mean, apparently, Virgil van Dijk is the only centre-half in the entire world that Liverpool could sign.
This is true.
Like, I mean, you know, they signed someone, for the love of goodness, that Dejan Lovren apparently is playing through serious pain. And
you make a very good point. Yeah. And I guess what would worry Liverpool fans, Ollie, is that there's no signs of, you know, sometimes a defence goes through a bad patch and then they come out the other end of it. It doesn't look like the Liverpool defence is getting better by playing more together. He's sticking with the same partnership, you know, that Lovren Matip partnership, it doesn't seem to be getting any better. And the weaknesses don't seem to be getting eradicated on the training pitch. It's something that Alex Ferguson used to do really, really well, is when United went through a phase of, you know, conceding, not keeping a clean sheet for five games, he'd go, right, we're tightening it up. Yeah. We're not conceding any goals for five games, even if it's a couple of goalless draws. There doesn't seem to be any improvement with Liverpool in the defensive area.
No, exactly. You look at Liverpool's squad and there's maybe four or five players that you look at and say, yeah, their games have really gone to a new level under Klopp. Mm. None of them, you'd say, are defenders. I mean, Trent Alexander-Arnold was given his debut by Klopp, so, you know, he's obviously come on. But the rest, you know, Lovren is the same Lovren that they signed a few years ago. Matip is very up and down. The goalkeeper situation we've talked about loads. And I think, you know, if you compare it to Spurs, for example, I mean, Spurs had Vertonghen for ages, basically on his own, and he looked lost. They brought Alderweireld in, suddenly they're the best pair in the league. But Poch has developed every single fullback he's had as well. Look at Ben Davis at the moment. Even Trippier has, you know, become a half-decent top six fullback as well. Liverpool, you know, none of their defenders have been improved since Klopp came in, and it's quite a damning sort of indictment of his coaching, really.
Nathaniel Clyne, the proof in the
I mean, yeah, you look at the goal they conceded at the weekend, and okay, fine, it was unlucky. Matip tackles the ball and it hits sort of and bounces in.
Top class centre backs don't let that happen.
But no, forget that, mate. Look at the way that Osimhen even got in. Those two, he runs right between them, like they're standing there, and
they're still playing like strangers.
Yeah, he's been there every year. There's no communication whatsoever. Neither of them have any what you would call terrific recovery pace. So you can't be like, I mean, this thing when he was at Dortmund, he had Subotic, who had incredible recovery pace. You can't play that kind of Highland football that sloppily and not have recovery pace. You're just going to get murdered every time.
Manchester United 4, Crystal Palace 0. No Pogba, no problem for Mourinho's men. Mo, how bad were Palace, though?
I mean, speaking of getting murdered, bloody hell.
I mean, they're awful. Hodgson was fairly defiant in his post-match press conference, saying, look, I can't fault them for effort, but they were shirking challenges, there was lack of marking. Bakary Sakho is not a striker. It's really painful to watch.
Well, it's exactly why they should never have sat Frank de Boer before these games. I mean, we said it last week.
We've said it every week for the past 3 weeks. No, it's crazy.
And we're going to say it again when they lose to Chelsea after the international break. It's the maddest thing to sack him before these two games, because, honestly, Roy Hodgson has no chance, and it's going to get his return after such a bad start. Mm. And Hodgson is the kind of manager who needs a while to get his players into his rhythm anyway, with the way he's, you know, tightening up his whole old-school training methods, tying his defenders together with ropes and stuff. You can't, that stuff doesn't take effect immediately. That takes a while to kick in. And not like Frank de Boer a while, but, you know, it'll take a while. It'll take a couple of weeks, 3 weeks. But, you know, playing Man United and Man City, I mean, for all we know, they have improved. We just can't tell because they play the two best teams in the league.
This is what I was going to say, Ollie. I mean, is there, like, for Crystal Palace fans listening, or the 2 million of them who listen to this podcast every week, what's the hope for Palace here? Because a lot of the fans were saying that was the worst they've played all season at Old Trafford.
I think the only hope for Palace fans right now is
Wilfried Zaha. Thank you.
Well, apparently his injury is, you know, they're not sure when he's going to come back. So
Christ,
let's not even touch on that. I think the only hope is Hodgson at Fulham, hoping he can just pull a rabbit out of the hat like he did at Fulham. You know, maybe Diamante Camara they can coax out of retirement and get him to score a couple of goals for them. But honestly, it's so desperate. When you look at it, just when you break it down, just statistically, it's really, really is horrendous. Is it 20 goals conceded, something like that? None scored.
Still not scored.
You know, those seven defeats.
It matched Portsmouth's record now for most consecutive defeats at the start of a Premier League season. That was the season that Portsmouth got points deducted for going into administration as well. So they'd given up, basically. Yeah. So this is bad.
I mean, yeah, they made a strange decision appointing Frank de Boer, and then they made it even worse by sacking him, and now they made a new weird decision by appointing Roy Hodgson, who's not very inspirational. Look, United are very good, City are very good, but, you know, that's part of the problem is, you know, you can't put Hodgson up against these teams and think, yeah, you're going to win. You know, first team, second game, and now they've got Chelsea. This is the thing. They've still got Chelsea to come. They're not going to win for 8 games, and then maybe they can start to get going.
We'll judge them in 8 games then, maybe. let's talk a little bit about Marouane Fellaini, speaking of making bad plays look good. I'm joking. His game by numbers versus Crystal Palace, 90% pass accuracy, 3 aerial duels won, 3 interceptions, 2 shots, 2 goals. He scored 3 goals in his last 2 games, 2 of them assisted by Ashley Young, which will surprise absolutely no one who's watched Ashley Young whip balls in the past. What a man, what a player.
What a man. I mean, look, this is what Mourinho said. This guy's really important to me. He's something very different. It's like, he's not what you would call a great footballer. He's learned now to stop trying to pass the ball ambitiously. He just keeps it very simple. 90% pass completion shows that. He's finding his wheelhouse. He's a battering ram attacking midfielder who doesn't do anything with the ball, keeps it very simple, and then just gets forward into the box and you cross balls to him. It's not complicated.
Rashford literally hit his head with the first assist.
Yeah,
it was really funny to watch.
He pinned it in there, but it's like going, knocked it in. You know, it's not complicated football. It's not what you would call top class football, but it works. You know,
effective.
It's not high efficiency, obviously, because crosses coming to boxes is a lottery, really, with what's going to happen. Today it worked, two shots, two goals, but sometimes it won't work. You know, sometimes he'll just miss them, he'll bounce off his shoulder, whatever. But it's high efficiency, it's low efficiency, but when it works, it's very effective.
Every manager needs a Fellaini-esque player in their squad, you feel. We've had a question from Keegan Blaze. What a name. Ollie, what does Ashley Young's revival mean for Luke Shaw, especially now that he's fit? And do they have to bring in someone at season's end? So Luke Shaw is now the 17th choice left back, I think, for Manchester United. It's definitely a spot where a top-class addition could be made. Do you think that's it for Luke Shaw?
It's not good news for him.
You know, looking good for Luke.
I mean, when Mourinho came in last summer, you'd probably think Ashley Young and Fellaini are two of the players that he might well just get rid of, because they're not title-winning players, you'd think normally. And the fact that Ashley Young is suddenly getting assists and Luke Shaw's just kind of sitting there twiddling his thumbs isn't great news for him. Do they have to bring someone in? If it's not Luke Shaw, then yeah, they do, because... You know, no matter how well their sort of understudies are doing, they still need a top-class left-back. Ashley Young's, 32 now? He's not even a left-back, really. You know, he's
right-footed.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they've got Darmian.
You know, they do need a specialist left-back. You look at, I mean, you know, it's a bit of a tough one for City losing Mendy, but, you know, in the few games that he played, he showed how important it is to actually have a specialist in that position. Yeah. Davis as well has been great for Spurs.
Yeah. Kolasinac
as well.
Arsenal.
You know, it makes such a difference having an actual specialist left-back who, you know, is very, very good. And if Shaw isn't rated by Mourinho, which is what it looks like, then they will have to go out and spend 30, 40 million to get a new one.
I mean, this market would be more than 34, I reckon. Mm. But yeah, look, they hobbled last season with trying to figure out the position. They didn't really do it. This season, they seem to have settled on a thing where when they want to defend, they play Matteo Darmian. When they want to attack, they play Ashley Young. It was Daley Blind was not performing. Crosses were poor.
Well, there's Marcos Rojo knocking about when he comes back from injury.
Rojo, I think, will play centre-back under Mourinho. I think Darmian is your defender when you want to defend, and when you want to play an attacking game, like at home against Crystal Palace, you play Ashley Young. He can get forward, he can cross. He's not a great defender. He won't play against Liverpool against the top six. It'll be Darmian in there if he's fit. You know, but like Ollie says, that's one season you can maybe get away with that. Like, it's not.
Might Liverpool be tempted to pick up Luke Shaw?
I think anyone really. His talent is not his issue, and from all reports, he's actually sorted out his personal life in the summer. I think it's now just coming down to Mourinho just doesn't fancy him.
Yeah.
I think any manager, I mean, Liverpool, good Lord, he'd be amazing under Klopp. The kind of manager who puts an arm around the shoulder and says, hey, you're really good.
Yeah, better than Mourinho, that's for sure.
Oh, I mean, good Lord, yeah.
Danny Rose, Luke Shaw swap would be the ideal, I think, for everyone.
No, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Danny Rose isn't going to get game at Spurs for a while.
Sure, probably have to take a massive wage cut, but if you're in his position, you've stalled hugely over the last 4 years. Yeah. Where better to go than the manager who sort of made you what you were in the first place?
I mean, you heard it here first.
I mean, no, with the way Davis is playing, that honestly looks like it might happen, because I think they don't need Rose right now, which is amazing.
Just unfathomable. Speaking of Spurs, Huddersfield 0, Spurs 4. Ollie, Spurs 7 away wins on the trot, utterly dominant. And Harry Kane has now scored just 7 fewer goals in 2017 in all competitions than Messi. That's 36 goals in 2017 for Harry Kane.
Is he world class, though?
Four-season wonder.
Well, we've had a question on that. Mr. Walker Porter asked, is Kane the best pure striker in the world at the moment? It's hard to think of someone else.
What do you mean by pure striker?
Yeah. Pure out and out, I think.
Number nine.
Well, Mr. Walker Porter means it was pure number nine.
I honestly think he is. You know, I mean, if we look at the numbers, I think him and Cavani are tied on 36.
Yeah.
I think you'd probably take Kane over Cavani at the moment. You'd take him over Lewandowski. You'd take him over Suarez, who's been sort of shunted out to the left wing a little bit at Barca. But yeah, he's been brilliant. This weekend, you know, it was just all about stats with him. He's got 16 in his last 7 away games.
Stupid. He's got 6 in 7 in the league, and he only started scoring in September.
Yeah, I mean, and he's got 5 in 2 games in the Champions League. You know, he's absolutely on fire. He's doing it every single week, and I think Pochettino sort of hit it on the head when he was like, you know, what do you want me to say about Kane? You know, I can't keep coming up with sort of things to say about him every 3 days because he's just scoring so many goals for me.
I mean, there's a reason Guardiola called Spurs the Harry Kane team.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look.
Which is doing Spurs a bit of a disservice.
Obviously, it's cool, but I mean, it does point out just how good Harry Kane actually is. I mean, and that was, Oli, I touched on it there. Lewandowski and Suarez were by far the best strikers in the world. I mean, I've done for like how many years, right? Mm. Lewandowski has not started this season very well. He's got 0.75 goals from open play in per 90 minutes this season. Mm-hmm. Not that he's scored 3 penalties, okay, fine, but he's not really doing the business. Bayern are struggling, and Suarez just looks like a ghost of what he was last season. Something's gone wrong with him. I don't know what the hell's happening there. So, I mean, and short of them, who is there on his level?
Benzema?
He's injured as well. It's basically like it's Cavani, Kane, and then maybe Lukaku. But I would say I would have Kane over Morata and Lukaku, not by a massive amount, but certainly by you know. I mean, look, like you said, the guy didn't score all of August, and is 1 goal behind Lukaku in the Premier League this season. I mean, that says it all.
Lukaku must be so fed up of him. He was, yeah. I mean, I remember last year he was running away with the golden boot, and then Kane was like, "Nah, I'm going to get like 8 goals in the last 3 games and just beat you to it by 4." Yeah. I fancy it.
Let's go back to the away record, because it's really good for Spurs to start winning these easy away games, because previously they've been a bit awkward for them.
Well, especially when they're not winning at home. Mm. You know, away form is taking on an even bigger, you know, it's even more important for Spurs this year when they've got the Wembley issue, which is still an issue, I think. You know, they absolutely battered Huddersfield, and they've battered everyone away from home recently. Yeah. It just suits them. You know, the way they're set up, I think, playing away is fine for them. And even at Wembley, when they're playing against teams that dominate, like Dortmund, it suits them because they can counter-attack so well. That team, you know, the back three with Sanchez coming in has been a really important sort of low-key addition to the Spurs side.
How good
has
he looked, by the way?
Yeah, like, he's perfect. He's slotted straight in.
He's 21 years old and just he's like, yeah, I'm in the Premier League. It's easy. Yeah.
The Pochettino effect. Speaking of young, talented players, Helena asks, will Dele Alli's unprofessional behaviour, she cites the middle finger during the England game, the dive at the weekend, hold back his career for the future? Mo, I don't see how it would hold back his career, but does it speak to an issue that maybe he needs to sort out? Although it's tempting to say that, because we used to say that about Wayne Rooney, and then he seemed to lose something from his game when he stopped doing all that nonsense.
Yeah, look, there are some players who are just confrontational. Look, what Dele needs to sort out is the fact that when he gets riled up, not so much that he does those things, is really inconsequential here or there, by the fact that he gets suspensions. The problem is that he loses his head and stops playing well. You know, that's the one. When he gets riled up, when he gets frustrated, he doesn't channel that into, let's say,
He gets caught as well.
Yeah, he just
silly.
He does well, yeah, because he's so non-sneaky about it. He just does in the most blatant way possible. Like, if you're gonna do what David Silva does, man, just stick your studs into someone's ankles or something. You know, he gets caught. He's so blatant with it. But no, look, it's not going to hold him back insofar as he's a fine player even with those flaws. The flaw he has, he needs to get rid of. It's not the unprofessionalism. It's the fact that he lets it get the better of him. He's a fantastic footballer. He just needs to learn when he gets angry, just channel that anger.
I think with him, the thing is, we see these incidents come out when he's frustrated and not playing well, and he's not really at the top of his game at the moment. He's doing silly things like the dive. When you're diving away to Huddersfield 3-0 up, you know, it's not because you need to get a penalty or win. It's because something's, you know, it's just
not
clicking for you. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think as soon as he starts scoring goals again, these things will sort of evaporate and go
one
away.
One to keep an eye on. Everton 0, Burnley 1. As we said last week, Everton. Everton have kept just 1 clean sheet in their last 10 games across all competitions. Oli, at what point do Everton need to start panicking? Because Koeman's been backed, and he's been backed again, and, you know, he's being very honest in his pressers. He's being very open about what he thinks the state of the team is, which I think a lot of the fans are quite appreciating. But at what point do they need to start hitting that panic button?
Well, he's probably hit it already, because I think Farhad Moshiri tweeted out his support for Koeman in a iPhone note doc.
Yeah, I saw that.
Classic football move. Yeah. A Charlie Adam tweet.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with Koeman is, I'm just interested to know who sanctioned the signings at Everton, who had the big say, him or Steve Walsh, because... Mm. I mean, we've talked about it to death, but they just signed the same player in every position, and they're just so one-dimensional. And yeah, he's got to start worrying because, you know, if you look at that team, there's, I don't know. They've just got so many of the same player. Keane, Williams, Jagielka are all the same. They've got no width. They've got no pace. And Burnley found it really easy to beat them. And they've still only got two goals this season in the Premier League, which when you've spent 130 million, is not a good sign, really. And, you know, considering Lukaku scored, what, 25 goals for them and was their top second, he got their second most assists as well. You know, it's hardly a surprise that they're struggling for goals.
I mean, yeah, Gylfi is an amazing bright spark, but the thing is, what made him so good at Swansea was that there were other players he could play off of, players with pace, players with wide, players at strikers. There's none of that at Everton, so he's like trying to spark with nothing around him.
Well, Burnley's goal was an absolute wonder goal. It was like a 20-pass, ridiculous 20-pass move. But James Tarkowski and Ben Mee, I mean, versus Everton, these numbers are ridiculous. 31 clearances, 13 aerial duels won, 6 tackles won, 6 blocks. Didn't even commit a single foul. I mean, that speaks to a comfortable afternoon.
You know what that also speaks to? It speaks to the fact that Everton don't have a number 9. Like 31 clearances. There's no one in there challenging those guys. Yeah. That's just crosses coming in. They're going, all right, clunk, get rid of the ball.
Burnley are sixth. Is Sean Dyche the most underappreciated manager in the league?
Yeah, he's Sam Allardyce from 20 years ago. Not 20 years ago, 15 years ago.
20 years from the future.
15 years ago. No. Sam Allardyce, 15 years ago, it was when Bolton, he had Bolton up to sixth. I think 2004-05, they finished above Liverpool, or they were going to finish above Liverpool, who won the Champions League that year. Like that, Dyche is that level. Like Burnley are, I mean, objectively speaking, they should not be anywhere near, there should be 10 places below where they are.
So hard to beat.
It's mad though. I mean, away, they've picked up 8 points away from home from playing Chelsea, Spurs, Liverpool and Everton. They picked up 7 for the whole of last season. You know, it's absolutely mental. They lost their best defender.
Allegedly.
Who was playing for Everton this weekend. Just a word on Tarkowski, actually. Burnley didn't even sign a defender to replace Keane. Tarkowski was there last year, didn't even play.
Yeah.
He's just stepped up and, I mean, Ben Mee always has these numbers, by the way. He loves defensive actions.
His clearance numbers are always absurd.
So they're a perfect partnership. And they lost to Andre Gray as well for big money. So he's done an incredible job at Burnley, as Mo said. They shouldn't be anywhere near where they are at the moment. And I think the thing with him is it's all about, you know, people view him in the same sort of light as Allardyce. I was looking at Everton's next manager odds. Eddie Howe is way out ahead of him in terms of, you know, who the bookies think are going to replace Koeman. Which just shows, you know, Dyche is massively overperforming compared to Howe, but Howe's got this reputation for
nice football,
playing pretty football and all this kind of thing.
I mean, I would say that it makes more sense for Howe to go to Everton than Dyche.
I'm just making the general point,
aren't the players that Everton have to play Dyche kind of football. But yeah, no, I mean, that kind of manager forever is... I mean, everyone laughed at Sam Allardyce when he said, I could manage Barcelona or Real Madrid. But you know what? Honestly, if you look at Tata Martino, Sam Allardyce probably could manage Real Madrid or Barcelona. You know?
You brought up Tata in a Sean Dyche discussion.
Yeah.
That's hella.
Look, Sean Dyche is a very, very, very good manager. You know, who knows what he could do with a bigger budget, with more better players. You don't know. Maybe he would adapt to that. Maybe he wouldn't adapt to that. But I think he's a phenomenal manager. I think he deserves a lot of credit for what he's done.
Hopefully we get to find out what he does with a bigger budget.
I mean, wouldn't that be something?
Speaking of teams with bigger budgets, Arsenal 2, Brighton 0. Mo, Arsenal tied on points with Chelsea, despite having a pretty rough start to the fixture list. They've won 11 consecutive home games across all competitions. Have they quietly been impressive here? Has everyone sort of lost their mind? Marbles a bit talking about Arsenal.
Yes, I don't know why this happens every year. Oh, Arsenal lost 2 games. Oh, they're finished, mate. Arsene Wenger. Look, there's always problems at Arsenal, especially lately, because Arsene Wenger's, you know, kind of eccentric in his old age. But this is a manager who's won more Premier League games than anyone else. He knows how to get it done. People have to understand this about Arsene Wenger. He's not going to win a Premier League title anytime soon. He's past the point where he could really make Arsenal a competitive force, but don't doubt the man's ability to win Premier League games. It's what he does. He knows how to do
FA Cups and Premier League games.
Yeah, Arsenal struggled. They had some really ropey periods, but then they've got their stuff together quietly. It's always quietly. No one ever makes big noise about Arsenal when they win, except... Well, I mean, unless they beat a big team. Yeah, it's always just they quietly just get on with it, beat teams. He puts his team out, you know, makes mistakes, but usually writes them. Yeah, he's just a very solid Premier League manager at this point.
Speaking of players who exemplify kind of that quiet, under the radar, doing very, very well, Nacho Monreal has been, once again, in a left centre-back role, probably Arsenal's best player of late. Alex Iwobi, also very impressive, but fans have been raving about Nacho Monreal for a good while now.
Yeah, he was really important. Obviously, he scored the opening goal. He was the only player as well to complete 100% over 100 passes this weekend. I think he got 101. So he just sneaked over the line. But yeah, he's been really, really good. Just a word on Iwobi as well. You know, as you touched upon, I mean, him against Ozil, you know, when it comes down to natural talent, there's only one winner. But I think what Arsenal need right now is someone like him who can basically do, well, similar to what Sanchez does on the other side and just press and work for the team. And, it, you know, without Ozil, they haven't missed him at all because Iwobi stepped up and looks really, really good in the Arsenal side.
He makes things awkward for opposition defences. His runs are a bit unpredictable.
Well, he can stretch them as well. Yeah. He can stretch defences, which Ozil can't. And it's important when you're playing a 3-4-2-1 to have players that can do that. And yeah, Arsenal, look, Brighton actually played quite well as well. Brighton had their moments, but Arsenal never really looked too troubled. Brighton hit the post, I think. But other than that, it was a really professional job, which, you know, with Arsenal, you don't really say that too often. You know, they sort of just got the job done.
Alex Iwobi is a terrific defender.
Surprisingly good for a young lad.
As a defensive presence, he's so aware of where and when he has to track back. He's not just blindly tracking back, like, let's say, Wayne Rooney. He knows where and when to do it. He knows how to do it. He's very good at pressing. It's a weird thing to say because when you emerge, you're thinking, okay, here's another dribbly Arsenal attacking player. But he's I don't know where he's learned it from because it's not Arsene Wenger, but he's a really,
he's a big lad as well.
He's a really good defender.
He was great against Chelsea, wasn't he, a couple of weeks ago? He just gives Arsenal something else, I think.
Yeah. And if you put him and Welbeck together like they did against Chelsea, pressing from the front, you know, 20 out of 20. West Brom 2, Watford 2, Richarlison's game by numbers. Everyone's talking about him, Mo. Seven shots, four crosses, four aerial duels won, three tackles won, two take-ons, one assist, one goal. What on earth? Who is this guy?
See, this is why Watford are so great. It's this kind of scouting that they scout places that other. I mean, it's probably part of being the Pozzo network, but it's this scouting these players like Richarlison. Where has he come from? What is going on?
The Pozzo network still sounds like, I don't know, like a TV network. Like next on the Pozzo network, yeah. Richarlison.
Well, I mean, hey, and I'd watch that show.
Yeah,
this guy gets it done. He's a really interesting attacking player. You know. It just seems to baffle teams, really. Yeah, yeah. It's hard to. I mean, you know, putting two past the Tony Pulis side is no joke.
Yeah, that is a very good point. Watford are now level with Liverpool, and they're just behind Arsenal and Chelsea. Ollie, a lot of teams predicted them to have quite a good start to the season. Marco Silva, some good transfers, but even so, they just look awkward. They look like the sort of team that it's really difficult to beat.
Yeah, they've only lost one game, which is against City, and obviously you feared for them this weekend. They went 2-0 down within 20 minutes against West Brom. Usually, no matter how good you are, when that happens, that's it, game done. And they sort of found a way. They got an equaliser before half time, and then they just battered West Brom for the second half, and eventually got that goal in injury time. I like this side quite a lot. You know, I think Silva's doing really great things there. He sort of moulded them into quite a complete unit. They're a lot more solid than they were last year. But you know, with players like Richarlison and Andre Gray, they have pace up front.
Yeah.
They didn't have that last year with Deeney and Okaka. They're just trundling on really nicely. And they look, I mean, everyone thought Everton would be nailed on for seventh. Watford are looking like a top half team at the moment.
West Brom started off work quite well, as you said. Matt Phillips has now recorded 10 Premier League assists since the start of last season, at least five more than any other West Brom player. He's a bit of a standout on the wing. Let's move on to West Ham 1, Swansea 0. Swansea sucker punched yet again. Mo, it seems like, although everyone liked the look of that Abraham Boney attack on paper, Abraham's obviously, you know, he's getting to grips with, you know, sort of leading the line in the Premier League. It doesn't look like it's clicked yet. No team created fewer chances than Swansea this weekend, which speaks to the fact that up front it's not quite clicking for Clement.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with those two as a striking partnership is that there's not really much pace there. And I think when you have two players who are kind of similar, like penalty box poachers, and you have no pace, they can't play together. I find it hard. Like, part of the reason why, for example, Wayne Rooney and Carlos Tevez worked, whereas Wayne Rooney and Van Persie didn't work, was because all those two players are similar, but when Wayne Rooney and Van Persie played together, there was no pace. When it was Tevez and Rooney was younger and faster, and Tevez had loads of pace. And, you know, pace allows you to sort of mix things up, even if you want to occupy the same spaces. You know, you look at those two up front, Abraham Boney, no pace, and he's not really integrated Roque Mesa yet. And Mesa is the key.
He's on the bench.
He's the key for their whole system to work. You know, he's the pass master, but until he gets adapted to the Premier League, gets used and comfortable to the Premier League, they can't really use him. I understand why Clement's not throwing him in there. It's the right decision to do, but it just means that until he actually does enter the fray, they're going to look kind of disorganised and disjointed.
Yeah. Stoke 2, Southampton 1, Ollie, another win for Mark Hughes' men, who are defying a lot of early season predictions, and another goal for Peter Crouch, 36 yes. years old.
He's still doing it.
He just gets goals.
I love seeing Crouch score. Yeah, it's brilliant, and he really celebrated it as well, which was nice.
he knows there's not many left in the tank, so he's celebrating everyone.
Just the thing on Stoke, slightly unfortunately for Hughes, his best player is a lone player, because Zouma has pretty much been their man of the match every single week. He was brilliant again this weekend.
I will be honest, I predicted that to be a total disaster. Kurt Zouma's been incredible.
He's been very, very good.
In my defence, I would say it's because I saw the Zouma's Shawcross partnership being a disaster, but instead Shawcross just been relegated to the bench while he's been injured.
I just can't
believe
Chelsea sent him out on loan. I think that's the craziest thing. They spent all that money on Rudiger and then sent him out. Keep Zouma, sign defenders, sign midfielders, bro. What are you doing?
Bournemouth 0, Leicester City 0. I mean, apparently, I didn't watch it, but apparently this was dreadful. Any comments?
I mean, look, Leicester are one of those hit and miss teams now. I mean, obviously, they're never going to recreate what they were when they won the Premier League. But now they're at this sort of state where they can be really quite turgid to watch. But then they have these games because they still have players who have remnants and memories of that amazing season. So Okazaki, Vardy, Mahrez, you know, they can still produce those moments of magic. But ultimately, what happened to this team is they gutted that midfield. Drinkwater and Kante were the heartbeat of that Leicester team, both defensively and offensively. And now they're both gone. So it's like, they can't recapture the full rhythm really until they replace both of those players, and they haven't replaced either of them. I mean, Ndidi is a decent facsimile of Kante, but there's no one like Drinkwater team to pass the ball to move them forward right now, and they're relying on moments of magic from Albright and Mahrez and Okazaki, and then Vardy being clinical to
create. They dropped Mahrez at the weekend as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The thing with City, Leicester City, is, you know, when they won the league, everyone was banging on about, oh, this is so great, they never have any possession. You know, this is quite a refreshing change to see a team like that winning games somehow. They still never have possession these days, but they're just toothless up front. So I think they could struggle this year. I don't think they'll go down, but I can definitely see them finishing bottom half because they're not really creating much. And you can get them defensively, and they just don't keep the ball at all. Bournemouth dominated possession as you'd expect, and then, it's just two teams struggling for form badly.
Two completely toothless teams up front.
Exactly, yeah.
Great to watch. Let's move over to the international break. We're not going to do too much on this, but there are some points to cover off. England versus Slovenia on Thursday. Injury news is that Delph and Jones are injured and are a big doubt for that game. Just a win needed to qualify automatically for England. Mo, England are now used to qualifying easily ever since the 2008 debacle, but this feels like the easiest qualification yet. I mean, it was this has been a procession of processions.
It has been. I think part of that is down to England having
very easy group.
Easy group, good players as well. Mm-hmm. You know, and players that have hit form. And also, I mean, we have to say it, and no one wants to say it, but they've sidelined Wayne Rooney from the start. He hasn't played a big part, and that's really helped them play with a sort of youthful energy and vigour. You know, they've put Dele in positions where he should be, not playing him deeper to accommodate Wayne Rooney. Mm-hmm. They've stopped accommodating. Spain showed what you can do when you stop accommodating an old player who is a legend, but nevertheless is a hindrance to your player. They dropped Raul, became the best team in the world. Now, England aren't going to become the best team in the world for dropping Wayne Rooney, but they've improved massively for getting rid of him.
Does Southgate deserve credit for how easy this has been?
I think Southgate has done a really, really good job. I mean, look, time will tell whether he'll be a great England manager by how he does at tournaments. That's always the mark of it. But he's done very, very well so far. I mean, he deserves to have a lot of faith shown in him, because England probably aren't going to win the World Cup. But, you know,
Seems to have solved a lot of the issues that were pertinent under Roy Hodgson.
Yeah, I mean, he's made a clean break with the past. He's not clawing up players that basically have no future. He's trying to build something. He's really put Kane and Dele front and centre, and as he should do, as they're England's two best players. Mm-hmm. He's just making a lot of... I mean, it sounds stupid. He's making a lot of very sensible decisions, which a lot of England managers in the past haven't done. It's easy.
Set the bar low in England.
It's easy to not give Southgate credit because he's making... You're saying, well, obviously you do that. But the thing is, how many England managers didn't do the obvious thing? Mm. You know, obviously you're not putting Gerard and Lampard together, and yet every England manager for 3, 4, 5 years tried to do it.
Ollie, the obvious thing seems to be play Rashford, Sterling and Kane, who are all in tremendous form. Do you think that's going to happen? Because that would be fun to watch.
Yeah, but then how do you fit Dele in? That's the thing. I think it'll be three or four with those. you know, he's played 3-4-3 and 4-3-3 generally as England manager, Southgate. So yeah, I mean, with Dele not sort of firing, then maybe it will be that front three. You know, we saw Rashford. Yeah, admittedly it was against Crystal Palace, but I love his sort of rivalry of Martial this season. It's really getting the best out of both of them. They're both coming in and scoring and assisting whenever they're playing. So that's a really big positive. And Sterling is, you know, kind of he's flown under the radar a little bit. No one's talking about him really, but he's becoming really, really important for the City side. And you know, with those two supplying Kane in this form, you know, it could be a
double hat trick for Kane.
One for Slovenia.
We won't accept anything else. Meanwhile, Scotland in the same group play Slovakia in a must-win game for the Scots. So Scotland, if they win both their games, they could get second place, basically. They're guaranteed second place if they win both their games. They just have to play Slovakia and Slovenia,
yeah,
which is
really tough,
not
games.
Easy.
Yeah, I'm not sure they've got what it takes to beat Slovakia. I don't know about Slovenia, although Handanovic in goal is always a difference maker. But I think Slovakia with Hamsik, I think they could be a much more difficult prospect for Scotland. You know, it'd be nice to see Scotland actually get to a tournament for once, because they always seem to miss out. Even at Euro 2016, when all the home nations went except Scotland, it was like, oh, come on, guys! You know, you want the tartan army in there.
Well, we'll see. If two wins, that's all they need. Mind you, Slovakia have looked pretty impressive throughout qualifying. Wales play Georgia in Tbilisi. Very slim hopes of topping the group, but they can still they're still pretty much guaranteed automatic. But they need to get points because they need to hold off Ireland. If they want that second place and potentially go to a playoff. Ireland are playing Moldova, so we'll probably keep up the pressure. Basically, Wales and Ireland have been in a bit of... They hit form. Both teams hit form very late. And, you know...
Well, Bale's back.
Bale's back is the big one for Wales, and Ramsey's playing very well for Arsenal. So.
I mean, Ramsey always plays well for Wales, but especially now he's playing well for Arsenal, who really do. But the thing with Bale is, obviously, he struggled for the last season, basically, with fitness and injury, and that's been a problem for Wales.
Well, he was rested by Zidane for their game against Real Sociedad.
Yeah.
So he should be fit and raring to go.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I think he'll be healthier. It was Espanyol, but I think he'll be... He scored against Real Sociedad. That was when he got his comeback goal. Lovely goal that it was. I think Bale is going to be really big. I think he'll make the difference. I think he'll push Wales over the line. It's like basically bringing on. You know, it's like he's basically effectively, in terms of the qualification, he's a late sub and he's a world class player. So I think that's going to make a big difference.
Bit of the Mighty Ducks about it. Like, you know, Coach Bombay like manages to convince the star player at the last minute to come back in. If you don't know what Mighty Ducks is, that was my childhood. Northern Ireland played Germany. Both spots are pretty much sealed there. Germany first, Northern Ireland second. Well done, Northern Ireland. They will almost definitely go to a playoff. Yeah. And then it's all about that late Gareth McCauley winner, which is absolutely inevitable.
It all comes down to the luck of the draw for them. Yeah. But I mean, similarly to what we were talking about Sean Dyche, no one ever talks about Michael O'Neill and what a job he's done.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
You know, you look at Northern Ireland, besides their West Brom contingent, which is pretty large, you know, they pretty much don't have
and
any
Davis,
Premier League players. Yeah, Stephen Davis, yeah. So it's absolutely incredible what they're doing. They've been second the whole time as well, which you'd expect. Well, you wouldn't expect that, but you'd expect Germany to top that group, and they've done so easily. And Northern Ireland have been far and away the second best team in that group. So
just to be finicky, there is a chance Northern Ireland top the group, but they need to beat Germany and Germany to lose their other game and then win their other game. So
that's not going to happen.
Almost definitely not happen. Speaking of playoff action, so we should probably mention Syria. Yes, Syria are playing Australia on Thursday. It's the first of the two-legged playoff to play the fourth place team in CONCACAF. So if Syria beat Australia over two legs, unlikely, I know, but Australia without their captain Mile Jedinak, and then they go on to play the fourth place team in the CONCACAF group, which could be the USA. Ooh. Syria USA for a chance to go to the World Cup.
Political ramifications.
Could you imagine that? that would be amazing.
That's pretty loaded. Sadly, I don't think they'll beat Australia.
Yes.
Because Australia are, you know, Australia shouldn't be in the Asian Confederation. Let's just put it out there, really. They should have been in Oceania, but they got upset because they kept getting beat up by
Uruguay.
Uruguay, fifth place South American team would always beat them. And so they're like, oh, we want to change. And then I think FIFA changed the playoff order, so now the best team from Oceania doesn't even play the best team, the fifth best team.
And now they've bottled the group in the Asia.
Yeah,
one,
I mean,
so
yeah,
it's well
just,
done, lads.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
let's move. Not a lot of time left, so let's move over to the Q&A. You guys send us questions every week, and they're always great. And so we asked them to our panel this week. Ollie and Mo are going to be answering your questions. First up, Henry K. Almeida asks, Mo, I think this one's for you. With Aguero's injury, would you prefer to see Bernardo Silva as a winger or in the middle where he can create more chances? He came on against Chelsea, Bernardo Silva. Yeah. Looked impressive, maybe trying a bit too hard. He's not really staked his claim. David Silva's been amazing this season.
No, I think, look, Bernardo Silva is a young player. I think they bought him for the future, essentially future-proofing the team against David Silva, against age suddenly striking down David Silva. Essentially, he is basically the next David Silva. He can play on the wing to offer them more control out there, you know, in a 4-3-3, or he can play centrally in a 4-3-3 in a midfield role in lieu of Silva, essentially. I don't think we'll see him as a false nine. I don't think Guardiola has any need to do that, really, unless of course Jesus gets injured. I think, and honestly, if Jesus does get injured, I think there's better choices for false nine than Bernardo Silva, namely Raheem Sterling, who's playing phenomenally well and scoring goals right now. I think best place for Bernardo Silva is honestly just wherever Guardiola can put him in the team, because right now it's just about getting him minutes, getting him acclimated to the Premier League and to his teammates, because he's a phenomenal footballer and he's going to be a difference maker for City. What I think is brilliant for City is that it doesn't have to be right now. They can take their time with him.
They can wait, because David Silva is still one of the best players in the league. Next question, Axel asks, Ollie, why does Conte persist with playing Fabregas in a deeper position? I think that maybe a bit reactionary after the City game. Fabregas didn't have a great game, looked completely outclassed by Kevin De Bruyne, as you'd expect, given the physical mismatch there. But why does Conte persist with playing Fabregas in a deeper position?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head, really, in saying it's a bit of a reactionary question, because before this, you know, he was working fine. You know, what the sort of beauty of playing the 3-5-2 is that it can accommodate a player like Fabregas. You know, last year everyone was writing off his Chelsea career because Kante and Matic had locked down that central midfield partnership. And Kante and Bakayoko are the two this year. But if you get Fabregas in there, that's another creative mind that can unlock a defence. So when it's working well, like it has been working, then it's great having Fabregas in there, because, you know, he still is one of the best players in the league for creating chances out of nothing. You know, his passing in the final third is brilliant. I think it's a little bit reactionary. I just think Chelsea, you know, sort of on the whole, didn't have a great day at the office. And, you know, Fabregas is a bit of an easy target. You know, he often comes in for a bit of criticism when he doesn't play well, but more often than not, he does. I think he'll be fine. You know, it's just about Conte. I think, you know, he should probably change his tactics now and again. Fabregas isn't a guy who's going to play every single week, but against sort of most teams in the league, having Fabregas in there is definitely an asset for Chelsea.
Yeah, his range passing is superb. That's why he plays there. It's to be a sort of
link man.
Yeah,
he's a link man, really.
I mean, to quote Karl Anka, or to paraphrase Karl Anka, a store brand Andrea Pirlo.
Store brand Andrea Pirlo. Do you know who is having a good day at the office, Ollie?
You.
Beautiful. Nicola Quales asks us, so obviously we had a load of questions about this, and we're going to try and keep it factual and not get too into the details or talk too much about what happened in the political situation. You can find information about that and opinion about that everywhere else. But Nicholas Qualis asks, was Messi playing with a Sunday league crowd one of the weirdest things you've seen in professional football? Mo, to have basically the best player of all time playing to an empty auditorium was a bit odd. Also having a great game, by the way.
It was odd. I mean, no, yeah, he had a great game. Barcelona had a rough first half and then really stepped on the gas second half to beat Las Palmas. It was weird. It was a very strange situation, but it was the right... I mean, well... It's the second best decision. The best decision they could have made was to cancel the game. The game should never have been scheduled for the day of the Catalan independence referendum. I think that was very sneaky from La Liga to do that. But, you know, sticking to the facts, look, it should not have gone ahead. They should have cancelled the game or postponed it. But obviously, they wouldn't agree to postpone it. And so they probably threatened Barcelona with, look, you're just going to lose a point. You're going to have a points deduction. You're going to lose the game. So that's 3 points down. Yeah. And you're going to have a points deduction. So that's six points.
There were rumours they were threatening to ban Barca from La Liga.
I mean, that's
6 months.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so in that situation, yeah, you play the game. And you play it behind closed doors because the fans, you couldn't trust the police to organise, to safely deal with fans that day after what they were doing in downtown. I mean, I don't need to talk about it. You've seen the images. You know what happened. It was shameful, really. And you can't trust the police to actually steward the game as they normally would. So, yeah, you play the game behind closed doors. It makes sense. It was weird, but it made sense.
An odd sort of halfway house. Ollie, we had another question on this from Mohamed Khurshid. Is what would, purely hypothetical, obviously, but what would be the best league for Barca if they were to live La Liga? Because, let's face it, this is only the start of this whole issue. It's not going to go away. Would uncertainty over Barca's future make them an undesirable place to go for other teams. I mean, can you foresee a situation where Barca would actually leave La Liga, maybe join another league or set up their own league, or the players would disappear? I mean, it's a very odd situation, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we're some way off that, hopefully. I mean, it would be an absolute catastrophe if Barcelona left La Liga, because, you know, Spanish football relies on Barcelona. Barcelona are the big, you know, along with Real Madrid, are the big draws to that league. So if they went, you know, suddenly their product is a lot less, you know, attractive. Mm. If Barcelona were to leave, just chuck him in the Premier League. Why not? It's not too far away.
Fun.
We can see Messi finally at the Pottery, see if he can do it.
Hey.
But yeah, no, it was a bit bizarre this weekend, but hopefully the football can remain the football and as separate as it can be from, you know, the things going on off the pitch.
I mean, there's been talk that, you know, there was always talk that if Catalan independence went through, if they became an independent state from Spain, that La Liga would kick them out of
they, you know, never would.
It just sounds like absolute.
But then look how much, like, they tried to stop Neymar from leaving. You know,
it just sounds like absolute blustery nonsense. That, you know, you would actually, yeah, look, you are our most popular / second most popular team. You make us absolute avalanches of money. Yeah, go away. We don't like you. It sounds like it's
a bit of a playground threat.
Given how much money it motivates football, I think that would be mad. But I think if they did do it, I think I'd like to see Barca any league, mate. Like Liga would be nice.
That'd be fun.
You know, Liga would be the one that makes the most sense, because of course Monaco play in Liga, and that would be the precedent to set. And Liga would love that, because I mean, right now it's PSG are just going to run roughshod over that place, I think, for a while.
6-2 they won at the weekend.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, you bring Barcelona in, oh boy, Neymar versus Barcelona twice a year, that'd be fun.
That would be a lot of fun. That's all we have time for. Massive apologies to the other leagues around Europe. We had a lot to cover. We'll be back again on Friday with a slightly different pod, because there's not that much to talk about with international break. We know that you guys aren't 100% keen on it. Before we go, got to mention Defending in Numbers, a Deezer original made by the people who make the Squawker Talker. That is us. New episode is dropping on Thursday morning. Check it out. Subscribe on iTunes. Check it out on Deezer, obviously. Listen on Stitcher or anywhere you might get your podcast. But until then, thanks very much to our guest, Ollie Young-Miles. Thank you, Ollie.
Cheers, Nick.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's been good, as always.
Excellent. And thanks to Mohammed Butt.
Very much, Nick, and Ollie, and everyone, listeners everywhere.
Thanks, Mo. So thanks very much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you very soon. Bye-bye.